Friends, we welcome you here this evening to our Bible-based address. This evening, the title is The Resurrection of Jesus, a Historical Fact. And our speaker for this evening is Mr. Stuart Mansfield. And our speaker for this evening, my friend and brother, Mr. Stuart Mansfield, has asked that we read from the book of Matthew and the last chapter of that book, Matthew chapter 28 and the first 8 verses. That reading, friends, is an introduction to our Bible-based address for this evening to the title, The Resurrection of Jesus, a Historical Fact. And we draw your attention to our speaker for this evening, Mr. Stuart Mansfield.
Thanks, Simeon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and my dear young people. Thank you for joining us tonight to hear a Bible-based address on the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If we might be allowed to state, the resurrection of Jesus would probably be the most important event in history. It is the basis of the Christian faith, and it is the basis of the hope of the gospel and the promises of God contained in his book, the Bible. Now, the basis of our talk tonight is going to be on the Bible. While some may disregard the teaching of the Bible and its evidence altogether, to answer our lecture title, we must approach this subject as historians, and we must examine the evidence that we have before us. To understand how to do this, what you need to do is you need to split the Bible up. And what I mean by that is, although the Bible is a single book which details God's purpose with the earth and the salvation he offers in the gospel, it's actually a collection of writings. It's written over the course of 5,000 years in 3 different languages and said to have had 40 or more than 40 contributors. And so we need to appreciate that each book of the Bible is in fact a standalone work. And this must be done because the process by which historians research history is what is called historical method. So historians use this to gather evidence of past events. They then evaluate the evidence, and then they interpret what the evidence reveals about the events that occurred in history. This involves looking at each book of the Bible as a separate writing, and we can then evaluate the historical evidence recorded by each writer. To consider the effectiveness of a writing on history and its events, historians use the technique created by, apologies if I get these names wrong, Garahan and DeLanglies, in 1946 on source criticism to determine things like whether the author was there at the time of the events, whether they had an eyewitness account, whether they were involved in the events personally, when the record was written, and then they used a procedure proposed by Boeheim in 1889 to compare what they wrote with what all the others in the same time period wrote of the same events. These are then all used to help determine whether the person who wrote about the historical event can be relied upon and whether their record can be considered reliable and therefore prove or disprove the events that they record. For example, have you ever read the historical commentary on the book or the works of Josephus? And you get to a certain section and the historian who's making this commentary says, oh, and then in such and such a place, he's wrong. How does he know that he's wrong? He's probably writing some 2,000 years after the event took place, so I guess there's little confusion that he probably wasn't actually at the events described to determine whether Josephus got the record right or wrong. How else do historians determine whether Josephus is wrong? See, what they do is they read other accounts of the events, and so if two other accounts say something contrary to Josephus, they determine that Josephus was wrong. Now, noting also with history and historical records, primary records are more reliable than secondary records. Primary being written within the same time period rather than secondary written many years after the events have occurred. Now, with this, my intention this evening is to use the Bible and its various records as historical evidence of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, without establishing this evening that the Bible is divinely inspired. What that means is that every word of the Bible and its writings and all the books contained in it are God-breathed. They are the words of God, and God tells us himself that he cannot lie. But if we might try and ignore this, if we can, this evening, and the inspiration of the Bible, we're just going to try and look at the writings of the Bible tonight. But you may wish to keep this in the back of your mind, that these words that are written are divinely inspired, and the people who recorded them recorded exactly as God directed them to write. So, on the basis of the historical requirements we discussed before, let's have a look at the writings found in this book called the Bible. So in this book, we have four different records of the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is, in fact, one of the few events which is spoken of by all four gospel records. All four gospel writers are primary sources. They lived in the days of the events. All four actively participated in the events. They had first-hand knowledge of what happened. They were eyewitnesses, and they were personally involved in the events. They wrote their records within a short period of the events occurring. And so this provides us a reasonably strong foundation to believe and accept the things that they wrote. In addition to the gospel writers, there's writings from people like Paul, who also saw the resurrected Jesus and wrote several letters contained in the Bible about the same time period as the gospel records. In fact, the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth is among the most well-documented events in the ancient world. Within 100 years of the event, 10 Christians, 3 Romans, and 1 Jew had wrote of it in the historical accounts that they produced. Now, although today we only have the record of 4 gospel writers and Paul, when the New Testament was written, there were many people still alive that had seen the resurrected Jesus. And we read about this in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3-8. We read there, this is Paul the Apostle writing, "For I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he was seen of Cephas, then of the 12. After that, he was seen of above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain unto this present, but some are fallen asleep. After that, he was seen of James, then of all the apostles, and last of all, he was seen of me also, as of one born out of due time." So this is recorded by Paul when he writes to the Corinthian ecclesia, and he states that over 500 people saw Jesus after he had raised from the dead. The greater part of these people were still alive when Paul was writing. Tells us that Jesus appeared to Cephas, then to the 12, and after that, over 500 brethren saw him. So in the days of the Apostle Paul, you could have gone and spoken to someone, a company of nearly 500 people, who had personally seen Jesus after he had resurrected. Now that is a huge testimony to the resurrection. Imagine you're accused of something, and to support your position, 500 people come forward. Now, you might argue that that is overwhelming evidence. And the evidence of this is so great that some people even suggested that Jesus therefore didn't die. Now, he just fainted. And so tonight I want to try and look at the whole historical record of both the death and the resurrection of Jesus to see if there is any support for such a claim, based on what the historical records contained in the Bible tell us. So to begin with, the death of Jesus was public. It was very public. It was witnessed by many, many people. He was crucified just outside the capital of Israel in a city called Jerusalem. And it was a very public event on the road that led into the city. We read in the record of John chapter 19, verse 19 to 20, and Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." This title then read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was nigh to the city, and it was written in Hebrew and Greek and Latin. So this verse tells us that many of the Jews read it. It was read by many of the Jews because the time of the crucifixion was Passover, and it's estimated that almost a million Jews would have visited the city Jerusalem. The fact that he died is confirmed for us by his enemies, the Romans. They confirmed that he died. If we read, and all the quotations this evening are on the board for ease of reference. So we read in John 19, verse 31 to 34, "The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the bodies should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was an high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Then came the soldiers and brake the legs of the first and of the other which was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water." So Roman executioners come, they find that Jesus is dead already, and with a spear they pierce his side. Now, you might think that John has obviously got this wrong, because when you cut someone, if you cut your finger, blood and water doesn't come out, only blood comes out. But there's an article written in The Lancet, it's a UK medical journal, and it mentions that in a regular body there is approximately two teaspoons of water that are contained within a layer around the heart. But this study found under extreme stress, this can increase dramatically to 100 millilitres of water, all the way up to 2 litres of water. So if a Roman soldier thrust a spear into the side of a victim, they would probably want to ensure that it was effective, and they would therefore aim for the heart. They wouldn't want to dilly-dally around with a soft stab in the leg or in the arm. It was done with the intent to kill the victim in case they had simply fainted from the exhaustion of crucifixion. So the rupturing of the sac around the heart of a victim of crucifixion would result in exactly what was written in the Gospel of John. Both blood and water came forth. Now, these soldiers were professional executioners. They knew what they were doing, and they would have done this many, many times before. Two of them certified that this man Jesus was dead. These men obviously don't take chances. So what you do is you take a spear and you shove it into his side, and you push it all the way through into his heart. Always best to be sure that your subject is dead. So, two executioners confirmed Jesus is dead when he was on the cross, and then they thrust a spear through him. In addition to that, he's also examined by a Roman centurion. That record is given for us in Mark 15, verse 42 to 45. "Now, when the even was come, because it was the preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, an honourable counsellor, who also waited for the kingdom of God, came and went in boldly unto Pilate and craved the body of Jesus. And Pilate marvelled if he were already dead. And calling unto him the centurion, he asked him whether he had been any while dead. And when he knew it of the centurion, he gave the body to Joseph." See, Pilate marvels that Jesus is dead already. So to confirm that this is actually the case, he calls a high-ranking official in the army and he asks him to confirm if Jesus is dead. So he's confirmed as being dead by a Roman centurion now. Now, when the highest Roman politician in the country calls you to confirm that this man Jesus is dead, well, you can imagine it wouldn't have simply been asked around what the gossip of the town was. This centurion would have gone out of his way to be absolutely certain, for fear of his life, that this man Jesus was dead. He probably would have personally done it himself and gone and seen the body. So now a high-ranking military official has confirmed this man to be dead. So he's confirmed dead twice by the Romans. After this, his body is then prepared for burial by people who, at the time, did not believe that Jesus would rise from the dead. We read about this in Mark 15, verse 46 to 16, verse 1. "And he," that is Joseph of Arimathea, "bought fine linen and took him down and wrapped him in linen and laid him in a sepulchre which was hewn out of a rock, and rolled a stone unto the door of the sepulchre. And Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, beheld where he was laid. And when the Sabbath was past, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, had bought sweet spices, that they might come and anoint him. So he's buried by two of his friends and women who knew Jesus personally from the beginning of his ministry. These same people came back after the religious feast to anoint his body after buying very expensive ointments. So two people who Jesus knew personally handled the body and arranged for his burial. These people were Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus. These men knew Jesus for a very long time. John tells us that Nicodemus came to Jesus at the very beginning of his ministry for a private interview with him. So he knew this man personally. It's not like sometimes today, you know, someone runs an undertaking business and is tasked with trying to bury a body, and so there's a possibility that they got the wrong person. Jesus was prepared for burial and he was put in a tomb by two men who knew him personally. These men are credible witnesses to the burial. They were the equivalent of the members of parliament, of the Jewish parliament of that day. Now, regardless of what you might think of members of parliament of this day, these men probably were quite capable of arranging for a burial and putting the body of Jesus in a tomb. But see, the fact that they were high-ranking officials and politicians, I think, adds to the support of the resurrection, because people of this class were too well known in their day to come up with some fictitious story about a burial if it wasn't the case. The fact that Jesus was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea also adds weight to the resurrection, because this man was a famous man and his tomb would have been very well known. We'll look a little bit later at the records that the rulers were not concerned someone was going to steal the body in the day because it was such a public place. See, if a story was being spread by a high-ranking politician that Jesus of Nazareth had risen from the dead, well then, people could simply go and check the tomb and see if it was empty. So, there were more people who witnessed the burial of Jesus. We read of these people in Luke 23, verse 55. And the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulchre and how his body was laid. So not only did they prepare the body, they witnessed its burial and they saw how his body was laid in the tomb. So if Jesus had not really been dead, for argument's sake, despite being confirmed as being dead by two executioners and a high-ranking military official, his friends and two members of the Jewish parliament, we might ask a question: why would his friends prepare him for burial and put him in a tomb and seal it and leave him there if he wasn't really dead? What would he drink? What would he eat? He was locked in a pit with no water. He'd just been crucified and suffered a horrific ordeal. Why would his seeming friends secure him in a tomb if he wasn't really dead? Even after he was buried, he was once again confirmed to be dead. We read of this in the chapter just before our reading this evening, in Matthew chapter 27, verse 62 to 66. It says there, "Now the next day, that followed the day of the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees came together unto Pilate, saying, 'Sir, we remember that that deceiver said, when he was yet alive, after 3 days I will rise again. Command therefore that the sepulchre be made sure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away and say unto the people, he is risen from the dead. And so the last error shall be worse than the first.' Pilate said unto them, 'You have a watch, go your way, make it as sure as you can.' So they went and made the sepulchre sure, sealing the stone, setting a watch." So these Jewish leaders wanted to be certain that there was no chance that Jesus could escape. So these men arranged to go to the tomb and they made the sepulchre sure. These actions were taken by people who had actually arranged for the death of Jesus. They didn't believe that Jesus was going to rise again. They thought he was a liar. They called him a deceiver. But they didn't want, sorry, what they wanted to prevent was any possibility that the body was going to be stolen, and then a suggestion that Jesus had risen from the dead. And so to prevent this, these men come to Pilate, I think about 12 hours after Jesus had died and he was buried, and ask if he could seal the tomb with a watch. Pilate says they could do it, but they were responsible for it. So first they went and they made the tomb sure. Now what that means is they opened the tomb, they went in, they made certain that the person buried there was Jesus, who they knew personally, and that he was actually dead. See, they would have looked pretty silly if they had sealed an empty tomb. And they probably would have looked just as foolish if they sealed a tomb with a body in it that wasn't Jesus. So if Jesus was alive, as some might have suggested, well, then they would have killed him. So Jesus' death is now confirmed once again, approximately 12 hours after he had already died by his enemies, the people who organised his death. Now, these men did this on what's called the Day of Preparation. It was an important feast for the Jewish people. These men were fastidious about being clean. They were constantly washing themselves and washing all the objects they used. During the ministry of Jesus, they actually ridiculed him for defiling himself with unwashed people and eating without washing. The fact that these men went to this great extent to certify that Jesus was dead, it would have made them unclean under the law of Moses. And I think the verses in Matthew chapter 27 imply that they thought it would be impossible to steal the body by day, because the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea would have been in a very prominent place, as we mentioned before. And so to prevent this, these men personally sealed the tomb and they left it guarded with professional soldiers. And they sealed the tomb with a great stone. Now, there's a couple of records of this great stone. In Matthew 27, it says, and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulchre and departed. In the Gospel of Mark, it talks about the women coming early in the morning, and they said among themselves, "Who shall roll us away the stone from the door of the sepulchre?" So it was large enough that two women felt they would be unable to move it. The size of the stone could be looked at in a slightly different way. In John chapter 20, it talks about Peter and John running to the tomb, and it says about Peter, "And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen clothes lying, yet he went not in." So it tells us Peter first comes to the tomb and he stoops down to look inside. So if he has to stoop down to look inside, it'd probably be about 1.5 metres high. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever tried to move a stone that's 1.5 metres high. It takes some serious effort and you'll need assistance to do it. Now, there's been suggestions that Jesus just fainted. He didn't die, and then he just revived himself in the tomb. But that theory then doesn't make any sense. The stone was so big, even if Jesus was in the tomb and he was alive, he would not have been able to move the stone. He had just been crucified and was seriously injured. The stone was also in a groove, which was common in those days, which needed to be rolled away. It wasn't as if you could just push it, which you couldn't do if you were inside the tomb. So the suggestion that Jesus revived inside the tomb and moved the stone himself doesn't seem to make any sense with the record. Even if Jesus was somehow alive in the tomb, how could he ensure that he came out of the tomb on the third day, which is what was required by the prophecies of old? He would have no idea of the passing of time, so he would have to try and guess when to come out of the tomb. And even if he managed to get all of that right, why would he leave his clothes behind? And even if he had managed to roll this massive stone away and get out of the tomb, Jesus didn't know that it was being guarded by professional soldiers. And so as soon as he steps out, the soldiers would have killed him. Obviously, it wasn't until the third day that anything happened. When it was dark, very early in the morning, Jesus was miraculously raised from the dead. The guards were disorientated by the earthquake, and the angels protected Jesus as he came out of the tomb. Now, the suggestion that the body was in fact stolen at the time by his disciples also doesn't make any sense with the records that we have, because it would be quite hard to steal a body in the dark. I'm not sure if you've ever tried to steal a body, but stealing a body in the dark is very difficult, I've been told. It would also have been quite a task to go and steal a body, as some have suggested, because it was being guarded by professional soldiers. But the record tells us that the guards were unharmed. The guards themselves actually said that this is not what occurred. They went and they told the truth, that Jesus had risen from the dead. The fact is, the enemies of Jesus, the people who organised his death, they believed the story told to them by the soldiers. We read about this. We read about this in Matthew 28, verse 11. Now, when they were going, behold, some of the watch came into the city and showed unto the chief priests all the things that were done. That's the things that we read this evening in our reading. The angels descending, the stone being rolled back, the great earthquake, the resurrection of Christ. And so when the chief priests had assembled with the elders and they had taken counsel, they gave large money unto the soldiers, saying, say ye, his disciples came by night and stole him away while we slept. And if this come to the governor's ears, we will persuade him and secure you. So they took the money and they did as they were taught. And this saying is commonly reported among the Jews unto this day. See, the enemies of Jesus, who organised his death, gave them a large sum of money and told them to tell a lie about the body being stolen. So the people who organised Jesus' death actually believed the record of the soldiers that Jesus was risen. And they guaranteed to the soldiers that if any of this knowledge come to the rulers, that Jesus had risen and escaped from their watch, that they would protect them. Now, they said they would protect them because the consequences of this is certain death. A few pages over in the record of Acts, in Acts chapter 12 and verse 19, there's the record of when Peter escaped from prison. And what it says there, and when Herod had sought for him, that's Peter, and found him not, he examined the keepers and commanded that they should be put to death. And he, Peter, went down from Judea to Caesarea and there abode. So that's the record of what happened to the guards who were on watch when Peter escaped. They were called before the ruler of the land. He examined them and then they were killed because their prisoner had escaped. Now, once Jesus was resurrected, the first person to discover the empty tomb and meet the risen Lord was not a group of men. It was not an honourable person. He first appears to a woman out of whom he had cast devils, or in common parlance, mental illnesses. We read about this in Mark 16, verse 9. Now, when Jesus was risen early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven devils. So it was a woman who had a history of mental illness. See, if the resurrection of Jesus was a carefully constructed fable or a legend, then it would make more sense that Jesus would appear to a man. In the days of Christ, women were a despised group who were considered worthless, but the record of a man might have some more weight to it. It doesn't add any weight to the fable by stating that the first person to witness the resurrected Jesus was a woman, much less a woman who had a history of mental illness. See, you wouldn't record this if you were trying to convince the world of something that happened. The only reason to record this to be the case is because that's actually what happened. Jesus rose from the dead, and the first person he appeared to was Mary Magdalene. Now, all of the post-resurrectional appearances, we're not going to look at everyone tonight, they were always to a group which included someone who did not believe that Jesus had risen from the dead. Even the contact with the risen Jesus was not like, you know, from a great distance where it might be Jesus, but possibly not Jesus. The records tell us that they ate with him. They sat down at the fire with him. They touched him. They embraced him like a friend. The people who went out and preached the resurrection of Jesus, they had nothing to gain in this life by preaching the fact that Jesus had risen from the tomb. They all suffered extreme persecution, jail, public humiliations, often very, very cruel deaths for the things they believed and taught. The last living apostle, John, he lived out his last days in exile on an island in the middle of the Aegean Sea. Now, the power of the resurrection even convinced some of the enemies of Jesus, the ones who were responsible for his death and organised the sealing of the tomb. Eventually, these people believed in the resurrection. We read about them in Acts chapter 6 and verse 7. And the word of God increased, and the number of the disciples multiplied in Jerusalem greatly, and a great company of the priests were obedient to the faith. See, a great number of his enemies, who were the group of people that instituted his death, they believed the hope of the gospel and the fact that Jesus had risen from the dead. Now, I don't think we could consider the power of the resurrection without looking at the man in the Bible called Saul, who later changed his name to Paul. He was once the greatest enemy of the disciples of Jesus and the gospel message. The book of Acts describes his actions as one who made havoc of the believers. He began a great persecution of the believers, forcing many to flee their homes. He took people that believed in the resurrection of Jesus and he cast them into prison, both men and women. He was the foremost opponent to the preaching of the resurrection of Jesus. But despite his beginnings, when he was journeying to Damascus, he received a vision from the resurrected Jesus and he was immediately converted. This man, who had sought letters to continue his persecution against the believers of the resurrection, he had a complete change and now became one of the most devout followers of the gospel and preachers of the resurrection of the resurrected Jesus. See, why would you do such a thing if the resurrected Jesus was not a literal reality? This man, Paul, actually interacted with a man who was once dead and had now been risen from the dead, and that convinced him to change his life. Now, you might wonder what he received for this great change of attitude and belief. Must have been something incredible to change such a person. Riches, honour, glory, lands. Well, what he received, he records for us in his writings to the Corinthian Ecclesia, and I'll just read it for you. It's in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23. He writes there to the Corinthian people, in labours more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths oft. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods, once I was stoned, thrice I suffered shipwreck, a night and a day in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of mine own countrymen, in perils of the heathen, in perils of the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness, painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Now, if you were Paul, why would you allow these things to come upon you and suffer so much if the resurrection of Jesus was just a fable, just some made-up story that didn't matter whether it was true or not or whether you believed it or not? I think the testimony of the life of Paul is compelling evidence to the fact and the power of the resurrection of Jesus. This man cast away everything in this life that he might accept the fact of the resurrection and the wonderful hope that it provides. So to conclude then, I believe we've seen tonight the historical record of the gospel writers and others provide sufficient evidence and corroboration to confirm their record as true, that Jesus was crucified, that he did in fact die, and that he was resurrected from the dead. And the consequence of this should cause a life-changing impact on us all. Because 1 Corinthians 15 tells us, but now is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept. For since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. The resurrection of Jesus provides us with an exceptional hope in the promises of God, and I therefore encourage you to think on these things and allow them to influence you in the days ahead so that you might accept the wonderful offering of hope that's contained in the Bible and benefit from the power and hope of the resurrection from the dead, based on the historical fact of the resurrection of Jesus Christ.